This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I have three guests from the HBO comedy series Silicon Valley. The show satirizes the creative and cutthroat world of tech startups, as well as the tech companies that have become giants, and the programmers, coders, marketing people, CEOs, and venture capitalists who inhabit that world. Mike Judge is the co-creator of Silicon Valley and created the animated shows Beavis and Butthead and King of the Hill. Alec Berg is the co-showrunner with Judge. Berg has also been an executive producer of Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm. Thomas Middleditch stars in Silicon Valley as Richard Hendricks, the brilliant but shy and socially awkward creator of a startup called Pied Piper, which has created an algorithm to compress and store huge amounts of data, an innovation that could change the ability to speedily access data around the world. Pied Piper is funded by a venture capital group that has chosen a board of directors. At the end of last season, after a Pied Piper fiasco, the board removed Richard from his position as CEO of his own company because of his lack of business and leadership skills. At the start of the current season, Richard was replaced by a new CEO, Jack Barker, and reluctantly accepted the offer to work as Jack's chief technology officer. In this scene, Jack, played by Stephen Tobolowsky, is showing Richard a poster of his business model, which he calls the conjoined triangles of success, diagramming the interrelationship of manufacturing, engineering, sales, growth, and compromise. Richard, played by Thomas Middleditch, speaks first.
The conjoined triangles of success?
I invented that, and now it's taught at business schools. You see what's on the bottom here? The foundation of the whole thing.
Growth?
Growth. The more brilliant people we can get working here, then the faster we can get whatever is in your head out into the world. Let me tell you a story. In 1999, Google was a little startup just like we are. And when they started bringing in chefs and masseuses, we thought, they're nuts. But they were attracting the best possible people, and they were able to create the best product, and now they're worth over $400 billion. And do you know the name of that company?
Google, right? You said it at the beginning of the story.
You're right. I did that wrong. And the whole point is that all of this is a sound investment as long as we are able to get the best people and make the best possible product.
Yeah, this is a scene from Silicon Valley. Mike Judge, Alec Berg, Thomas Middleditch, welcome to Fresh Air. Mike, let me start with you. Why did you want to do a show about Silicon Valley? You created King of the Hill, an animated series about a kind of old-fashioned, middle-aged, working-class guy who probably wouldn't know how to work a computer. So, like, the distance between King of the Hill and Silicon Valley is huge. Of course, King of the Hill is animated, too. Another big difference.
Yeah. And then Beavis and Butthead may be even further away from computer geniuses. But, I'd worked as an engineer a long time ago and just have been around the tech world a lot. My ex-wife's from Palo Alto, and I'd spent a lot of time there and actually lived up there and worked up there. So it's pretty far from King of the Hill, but it's something that's kind of I've been close to a lot of my life.
Alec Bird, what is your connection to the Silicon Valley, if any?
yes. Well, going back, my father is a biophysicist who builds his own microscopes. My brother was an electrical engineer who has worked at Microsoft and now works at Amazon. So I have some sort of nerd cred in my bones.
Is your family ever offended at the Silicon Valley jokes?
I don't know that my parents even know that the show's on television, to be honest. I get requests every once in a while for VHS copies of the show. I think they're amused that my name is on a television show that goes out to people, but I don't think they're of that world enough to ever take offense at anything we're doing.
Wait, was it your brother who works for Amazon?
Yeah.
Is he offended at the jokes?
Well, in the interest of advancing his career at Amazon, let's say he polices it very carefully and he speaks up strongly for the rights of Amazon at every possible opportunity. And I hope that gets him further in his job.
Thomas Middleditch, what's your connection to the real Silicon Valley?
Oh, very little. Very, very little. I guess my only connection is growing up
And still to this day, still a bit of a computer kid. I do like my games and my trinkets and my gadgets. But I never really took time to program or anything. I mean, I came into this project totally from the point of view as pretty much just an actor of just trying to get Richard down, and not really a good actor, because I didn't go to Silicon Valley and like research anyone or anything. I just sort of came in there with and took a stab at it, and it happened to be on point.
So the invention that Richard's company, and Richard's played by Thomas Middleditch, his thing is high compression cloud storage data. So in other words, you could like compress all the data in the world into a small amount of storage, store it on the cloud. It's not a sexy idea in the way that a new gizmo is sexy. You know, and it's like a hard thing to like demonstrate at a show in the way that Steve Jobs would demonstrate like the new iPhone or the iPad. So Mike and Alec, how did you come up with, you know, compression as the thing that the show is going to revolve around?
Well, part of the problem originally when we were writing the pilot is you go, okay, well, whatever app they come up with, if it's really to be believable that this app is successful and in demand and huge, you would have to believe it would be that way in the real world. It's sort of like when you do, if you're doing a movie about a band and then they have a song that's supposed to be a hit, that song has to really be a hit in the real world. Otherwise, the whole thing seems fake. And I just remember from school that compression was kind of an interesting thing, that there's different kinds, and still, especially in video, there's still probably room for something that could really compress it more. And I think it's realistic. You know, I talked to some of my old engineer friends, and they said, yeah, it's still possible that somebody could come up with a game-changing algorithm in that space, you know. So it seemed like something that's just, you know, people basically understand file size, because that's what, you know, when you buy a computer or your phone, you're paying for that. So, and it is sexy, I think, but, you know, what do I know?
Well, the nice thing about it for you guys is it's invisible. You know, like you can't like show data storage that, you know, compressed data that exists in the cloud. So you don't have to create a product for us to see.
Yeah, I also think that it being compression, it being sort of like an under-the-hood invention or whatever, that adds to the show's credibility. It makes it sort of for us, by us, you know, in terms of engineers and math people, which I think is a huge draw for the show. I mean, there's very little, you know, Twitter hate of like, hey, you got that wrong. If anything, it's like, implausible. Let me show you with my math how it could have been done. But it's never, you know, flag on the play, I call foul, absolutely impossible. And some of our consultants, I don't know who we can name, Doten maybe.
Yeah.
He thinks compression is like one of the biggest challenges we're going to face, because right now we have massive data storage centers, you know, these big warehouses, and there is a finite amount of space that we can do, and we're exponentially requiring more and more each year with every new cloud storage service site and every new way to create content. You have to store it somewhere, so some kind of like accessible, executable compression is actually a pretty revolutionary thing.
So Mike and Alec, I guess it's just Mike on this one. Tell us how you hired Thomas Middleditch to play the lead.
The only people I knew in the whole cast before that I'd worked with were Thomas Middleditch and T.J. Miller. But Thomas, we had always thought of as the lead, even though, you know, we weren't sure if HBO would go for it or whatever. But we actually named the character. The character's name was Thomas. Up until like a half hour before we were shooting,
yeah.
I think.
Thomas Pickering, which is, that's my mom's maiden name. And then when I finally got the script, I was like, oh, Thomas Pickering. Yeah, I guess that is a pretty good shoehorn of me trying to be in there. But I still had to audition. Right. But it turns out what Mike was about to get to before I cut him off very rudely is that he didn't really realize, right, that me and TJ and Kumail Nanjiani and Zach Woods, we'd all known each other for years. Like, I've known TJ and Kumail for about 10, Zach for maybe 7, 8. Martin's a new friend, but a good one.
Yeah.
And it turns out we're all buddies who perform live comedy still to this day, which is kind of surprisingly rare for a comedy show.
What are some of the advantages if you're doing a comedy series like Silicon Valley and all of your leads are stand-up comics?
Well, I'm sure there are pros and cons. I'm sure there are times where we're throwing stuff against the wall and you're like, that's great. And then other times where you're just like, please say the line. No. Stop trying to punch up my script I've worked for months on.
No, I mean, the tremendous advantage is that these guys have a rapport, and I think their camaraderie is real off screen. So I think that it lends itself to feeling real on screen as well. And also, they're all super funny guys, and they're creators of comic material. So you can give them a script, and they can nail all the stuff that's in the script, but then they can also riff on top of it and give you value added, which, of course, it says written by somebody else at the end, so we take credit for all of their work.
Yeah, we're our writer credits. Yeah. What's going on?
I know. Let's hear another scene from Silicon Valley. And this is the point, like, in the first part of the season, there's a new CEO, Richard, who is the creator of this, you know, high compression data storage algorithm. It's like his thing, and he started the company, but he's been fired by the lead investor that controls the board of the company. So another CEO has been hired, and at first he seems like, well, maybe he is a good guy. You know, he's done a good thing. He has a great resume. So Richard decides to come back reluctantly as the chief technical officer, but suddenly his ideas are getting totally undermined by this new CEO, because instead of this like high compression, you know, data storage on the cloud, now the idea is to, no, it'll just be in a box because it's easier to market that way. And the salespeople have been hired before the engineers have even been hired. So Richard is really angry and he goes to see Jack, the CEO, but he has to meet with him at a stable where Jack's prize horse is being mounted and inseminated by a stallion. So that's going on in the background as Jack, the new CEO, and Richard are having this conversation, and Richard speaks first.
Look, Jack, you and I have a problem. Okay, your salespeople are telling me to cut everything cool about the platform just because it's a little bit harder for them to sell. But don't you think because they are such amazing salespeople that it would be okay for them to sell the harder stuff?
No, doesn't work that way. The way you keep the best salespeople is you need to give them something easy to sell. Otherwise, they just go somewhere else.
Okay, well, Pied Piper could honestly be the global standard for file compression and storage. Every mobile device on the face of the planet could be able to access their data as if they had a fiber optic cable plugged into it. People in the desert, people in refugee camps, people who have nothing could suddenly have access to everything. You know, everybody in this industry, they say they want to make this world a better place, but we could actually do it. We could do it and make billions of dollars.
Richard, listen.
No, you listen to me, Jack. You promised me that you would never compromise the product. So, do you feel like taking some action and backing me up on this? Because me and my product feel pretty compromised right now.
Richard, I don't think you understand what the product is. The product isn't the platform, and the product isn't your algorithm either, and it's not even the software. Do you know what Pied Piper's product is, Richard?
Is it me?
Oh, God, no! No! How could it possibly be you? You got fired! Pied Piper's product is its stock.
Its stock?
And whatever makes the value of that stock go up, that is what we are going to make. Now, maybe sometime in the future, we could change the world and perform miracles and all of that stuff. And I hope we do. But like I told you before, I'm not going to mortgage the present for that. I need to move the needle today. And now, if you will excuse me, I paid $150,000 for the semen that's about to come out of that stallion, and I would very much like to be there to see that it happens.
And that was Stephen Tobolowsky as Jack and our guest Thomas Middleditch as Richard. I love the way this scene takes this like inspirational turn with that cheesy inspirational music in the background and the like, no, you listen to me kind of dialogue. And then it just totally hits a wall.
Yeah.
Can you talk about writing that scene and having that inspirational buildup and then, you know, ending the inspiration in total frustration?
I mean, it's interesting. We draw a lot of parallels from show business. And so all of this stuff about like art versus commerce and, you know, Are you doing something to make money, or are you doing something for the art of it? Like, all of that, I think we relate to as writers. And so it's easy for us to sort of put ourselves in Richard's position. And so that, you know, this whole arc this season of the box versus this kind of Hail Mary, you know, high and mighty platform that's the dream of Richard and the guys to build, I think is really grounded in this idea of, like, you know, anytime you write a screenplay or a TV pilot or something, you set out to make this brilliant, amazing thing. And then along the way, you have to compromise and compromise and compromise. And, you know, you end up making, you know,
Silicon Valley.
Yuck. Yes. Yuck.
Here we are.
This dump of a show.
But yeah, we drew from a lot of places. I think one of our tech consultants, Bob Solomon, who was a sales guy for years and years, was talking about this idea of the best salespeople will only work for a company where the product is incredibly easy to sell. And if the product is difficult to sell, they'll leave and go to a company where it's easier to sell it. So this,
what makes them good?
Like, yeah, there's this very weird kind of catch 22 of, like, you only get great salespeople by giving them something that a donkey could sell. So that went in there as well.
This season, it looks like your character, Thomas, your character of Richard, is going to have a girlfriend, or at least it briefly looks that way. But but you have a big fight about whether it's better to use the tab key on the computer or to tap out individual spaces. Would you explain what that fight is about and if people actually have that fight?
There's, like, memes of it's a big ongoing battle. I just got an email from my old roommate from college, who's an engineer up there for a pharmaceutical company, and he's like, "I just want you to know, I'm on the spaces side of that."
Yeah, it's funny, when we were talking about the idea in the writers' room, one of our writers texted a friend who works for Apple, just saying, "Hey, is this tabs versus spaces thing real?" And his friend who worked at Apple was out at drinks with a bunch of other engineers, and she replied that A, it is real, and B, just talking about it now has sparked a giant violent debate, and they were actually screaming at each other in a bar about whether tabs or spaces were better. So it's very real and apparently extremely contentious.
Yeah, well, that speaks to the engineer brain. The how do you structure your math? What do you feel is more efficient? And that is how Richard works, and that's how a lot of these people work in programming and engineering. It's like, you know, I feel like tab spaces can be synonymous with, I'm sure, a multitude of hot button issues. But that's exactly why I think this show, these writers, do so well at it, is like they bring in the material that's kind of real and relevant, and it's not like the fake Hollywood version of how people code. It's not like Hackers, where we go into a 3D realm and we, like, virtual reality interact with computers. It's like, no, this is a real debate of tabs versus spaces.
Well, you know, and the difference between tabs versus spaces in the show makes it seem like Richard prefers the tabs because they require less compression than the spaces. Is that what the argument is about in the larger world where people fight over this?
Well, Terry, some clarification here. It's also one keystroke as opposed to, what, eight?
I mean, the math
on that.
The argument, once it goes through the compiler, and then it's completely the same thing once it's running. So it's all before that. Jeremy Stoppelman at Yelp was telling us about a guy, I think that's what, who was so anal about it, he went in on and spent an entire weekend converting everybody's tabs to spaces, or the other way around.
Yeah, I think when he came in and took over a project, yeah, he spent something like 48 straight hours just deleting spaces and adding tabs, even though, as we said, once it goes through the compiler, it's utterly irrelevant, apparently.
I just can't stand to see people doing that. And I guess the argument for the spaces is that if somebody else has their tabs set differently and you run it in theirs, then it throws it all off, and it's just, yeah, I think that's, the spaces is more pure.
Would you be adjusting the tab? I mean, what purpose is my point?
Okay, I'm gonna storm out of here.
But one of the things we always try and do is, even though there is this very kind of technical debate going on, you know, we always try and turn it to what is sort of the most relatable part of it, which is that, you know, as long as the audience understands that these are two different things that are indistinguishable by most people,
right,
but that people are incredibly particular and, you know, violently specific about them. Like, that, I think, is where the comedy comes from.
Yeah, and I mean, that could just as easily be like, oh, I like to cut the butter this way and not gouge the thing with my knife when I do. But, you know, right. One of those things with a couple where it's like, you know, spaces versus tabs could be any of those things, like toilet seat up, down, or something, yeah. You know, and these little things that throw it all out of whack.
I want to play another clip from Silicon Valley, and this features Matt Ross as Gavin Belson, who in the series is the head of a company called Hooli, which is this like mammoth Google kind of company, and they're trying to reverse engineer the file compression and storage algorithm that Richard's company has come up with. The character of Gavin Belson is the most like narcissistic head of a tech company who wants to be an inspirational leader, but he's amoral, and he'll do anything, no matter how underhanded it is, to kind of get ahead of his competitors. So he's very upset that his company's search engine is bringing up negative articles about him, and he wants that to stop. And this is a scene about that.
How was everyone's morning? Let me tell you about mine. I started my day, as I always do, by typing my own name into Hooli search. I enjoy the ritual, which is designed to center me. But lately, it's been doing the opposite. Whose workstation is this? Observe. These are all remnants of a time before I wrote Nucleus down. Why are we allowing our own technology to dredge up our painful past? Why is it that when I type my own name into my own company's search engine, the internet rains bolts down on me? I want this to stop. These articles are part of the public record. Your point?
Are you suggesting that we alter the fundamental neutrality of the Hooli search algorithm? That's a clear violation of the public trust. Yelp is threatening to sue Google for this very thing. I can't, in good conscience, order Hooli search engineers to do that.
I never suggested anything of the sort. No Hooli search engineer will ever be asked to alter the neutrality of the algorithm.
And so Gavin doesn't want to see any more negative mentions of Nucleus on Hooli search.
So we're going to alter the search algorithm?
Of course not. That would be unethical.
What are we supposed to do? Promote other websites to outrank the bad Nucleus news? Do you have an idea how big a job that is?
Don't you swear at me.
We don't work here anymore.
For 10 more days you do. Unless you'd all like to quit and walk away from your entire severance packages.
That's a scene from Silicon Valley, and we heard Matt Ross as Gavin Belson, the head of the company Hooli. At the beginning of each season, you go on a research trip to various parts of Silicon Valley to see what's happening and what you can learn that you might be able to write in some way in the new season. So how do you structure those trips?
We'll try and talk to engineers. We'll try and look at some big companies. We'll tour some small companies. We'll meet with some VCs, some attorneys. We try to sort of cast a wide net because we're finding, you know, we get interesting, really funny, weird story ideas from all different places, and there's no kind of rule as to where they come from.
So when you're observing in Silicon Valley, do you pay special attention to what the offices look like? For instance, in this season, Richard's company moved basically from house with their new CEO. They moved to this like big office that has like fabulous furniture and little game kind of things around, and a professionally curated micro kitchen.
So, yeah, that was actually, we were at Quora, and somebody had taken a watermelon, hollowed it out, and put watermelon jello in there and sliced it up like pieces of watermelon. We used that in the show. Yeah, there's a lot of details like that. Actually, Richard Toyon, our production designer, goes up there also and takes a lot of pictures. And
it is amazing when we tour companies how almost exactly like our sets they are.
It seems like you can't hyperbolize it for a joke hard enough. Yeah. I mean, even I did a brief visit at Google X, and they have these little push scooters that you can go from one end of the compound to the other, and the floors are very smooth to maximize efficiency of the push scooters. There are kitchens. There's very robust ways of eating.
Yeah.
To quote Till Velasky, I want my coders hungry here and never here, pointing to his belly. Yeah. That's the thing.
I think it was Google, right? That they never wanted anyone more than 100 feet from food.
those little food stations all over the place.
And then when we toured Google, they had this philosophy of they've organized their offices to, and I think their phrase was, to hard code serendipitous moments, which basically meaning that, I mean, it was an incredibly unserendipitous, you know, way of saying that they wanted people who didn't know each other to be forced to interact with each other because who knows what could happen.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of, like, corporate harmony. It's namaste with a logo and everyone forced to be in a circle and say namaste. But like, it's like,
well, I think that goes back to, I think, the whole philosophy. I mean, it's the Bay Area, right? It's like hippie culture that has run headlong into rampant capitalism.
Well, you've coined several very idealistic sounding slogans that are used in business models and for corporations within your TV series Silicon Valley. Like, one of Hooli's slogans is, we can only achieve greatness if we achieve goodness, which is great because this is not like a nice company, and you know, the head of the company is ruthless. So I'm interested in hearing some of your favorite slogans that you've heard and or about slogans that you've written for the series. And I think as writers, Mike and Alec, your ears are probably especially sensitive to slogans.
Well, there was a Gavin Belson line in season two that to me sort of is the most kind of acute sum up of this sort of competitive altruism thing, where Gavin Belson at one point is excoriating the board of the company and he's saying, I don't know about you people, but I don't want to live in a world where someone else makes the world a better place better than we do. And to me, that sort of sums up Gavin Belson's kind of mindset, which is, you know, if there's any other jerk out there who's making the world a better place better than us, we better stomp them.
Right. And then you have some great, like, business kinds of slogans in there, like Jack, who for a while is the new CEO at Pied Piper, Richard's company. He talks about the conjoined triangles of success. And we've all seen those kind of business models with interlocking circles. So what are the three conjoined triangles of success?
Well, compromise is the shared hypotenuse of the conjoined triangles of success. That's the important thing.
One of our writers, John Levenstein, sort of made up the conjoined triangles of success. But the birth of that was, we just were asking a lot of questions about what would a CEO for hire be like. And a lot of people were saying, well, the big disconnect would be, as opposed to engineers who just want to make cool stuff, this guy would have systems. You know, and he would have ways of doing things, and he would consult org charts, and, you know, he would be very rigid in the way he organized stuff, you know, and a lot of that came from just asking questions about, you know, we were talking to engineers that did, like, we went to Yelp and we would ask the engineers about, like, well, what would drive you insane about somebody coming in and imposing stuff from the outside? And they all said meetings. Engineers hate meetings, systems, ways of doing things, rules.
Yeah, they have a thing at Yelp where there's one day of the week where there's just no meetings are allowed. I think it's like Wednesday or something.
Yeah,
like,
but what was hilarious,
we were having a meeting.
That was the day that we went up there and met with them. And so they were saying, yeah, Wednesdays, meetings are absolutely forbidden. We're like, but isn't this a meeting?
And all the engineers look at each other like, yo.
Yeah, that's more of a therapy session, I guess.
I know some shows like to change the writers every season or every other season so that there's always fresh blood and new ideas in the room. Do you do anything like that?
I mean, there's always attrition. Certain people leave. We get new people. Yeah. There's a decent amount of consistency. There's a few new people each year, and a few people move on to other things. But we don't have any kind of system in place that...
You don't have any conjoined triangles?
No. It's not like Logan's Run where, you know, oh, this is your 20th episode. Your time is up.
Alec, one of the shows you worked on before Silicon Valley was Seinfeld. And I'm thinking, like, Silicon Valley is about, like, the high-tech world. And one of the most famous episodes of Seinfeld is where George leaves a message on a girl's answering machine and realizes he wants to erase the message, and he has to like break into the house and try to steal the cassette from the answering machine so that she never gets the message. And when you think of the difference technology-wise between the answering machine plot and the file compression and storage plot, it's such a huge technological gap. Do you ever find yourself thinking about that?
Oh, sure. And a lot of times technology massively gets in the way of funny and interesting storytelling. Like there's somebody put together a really interesting supercut on YouTube of instances in movies where people are just looking at their cell phones saying, there's no signal. Because so if you think about it, like every kind of farcical story in the history of storytelling would be over if somebody just had a cell phone, right? And she's like, I'll just call them. You know, I don't have to go there. I don't, you know. And cell phones have destroyed so many good stories that people have just come up with this device of, oh, my battery's dead, or there's no signal. I mean, honestly, it's like a 9-minute long thing of, there's no bars.
I never thought about that, how cell phones would be damaging to storytelling.
Well, look, we deal with that all the time. Like, Monica, who works at Reviga, comes over to the house to talk to the guys all the time. The reality is she probably would never set foot in that house. She'd just call them. But scenes are much more interesting to shoot and to play between humans who are interacting with each other as opposed to phone calls.
She wouldn't even call. She would text, right? I mean,
yeah, probably. Yeah. Right. Well, that's actually, it was funny when we first started doing the show. I remember somebody's, one of the first kind of reviews of it we read was that some angry tech guy was like, this show's totally unrealistic because in reality, they'd be texting way more. And we're like, all right, so if that's your knock on the show is that people should be texting more?
That's what he wants to see.
Yeah. It's so fake. These people talking to each other and saying things and looking each other in the eye.
Yeah, and with that, he crawled back under his rock and went to bed.
At his mom's house.
Yeah. It's not my rock. It's actually my mom's rock.
What are the TV comedies you each grew up on that seemed very state of the art at the time?
For me, like Mary Tyler Moore and Bob Newhart, when I was a kid, were, you know, like she was a TV news person. He was a therapist. I don't know. They seemed kind of fresh and new. And but, you know, I'm old.
Do you feel like you've borrowed from those shows in any way, that they've been inspirations in what you've gone on to do?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I watched both of those pilots when I was writing the King of the Hill pilot. Yeah, for sure.
What was special about those pilots that inspired you?
Well, I mean, those were just shows I loved, and that, you know, kind of workplace, or, you know, just seeing how they establish the characters right off the bat. I mean, there's actually a moment, the Mary Tyler Moore one is good. There's one moment there, though, that's clearly a network executive note where she says to Rhoda, you seem like the type of girl someone could just really get to love. for no other purpose than, and it's right towards the end, and like, oh, we're worried no one's going to like her. But, you know, you already like her, and just because she's likable, and that was sort of an interesting, like, kind of lesson, and, you know, like, that you don't need stuff like that, really.
Alec, what about you?
I mean, to me, Letterman was a massive, massive influence, because it just felt like a show where, you know, some kind of ne'er-do-wells had taken over a studio and were doing a show in the absence of any kind of, you know, real authority or structure.
He also had such a great attitude towards celebrity that nobody had before, I thought. Like, it just made it feel like one of us has gone up there. And
but I definitely feel like, you know, we always talk about Silicon Valley as a show that's inherently about outsiders.
Yeah.
You know, and that whole, to me, the whole Letterman vibe was this guy was just a perennial outsider. He was never going to be show business establishment, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and you were just waiting for somebody to come in and throw him out of the studio and get back to work. So Letterman was huge to me. And then the other one, when I was in college, The Simpsons came on. And that show was just, in terms of just the density and the level of craft, writing-wise, I don't think there's ever been a show. The first few seasons of that show are I mean, I would watch those episodes when I first moved to LA and I was trying to become a writer. I would watch The Simpsons and it would just be depressing. Like for hours afterwards, I would just be despondent because I could watch those episodes and I would think, you know, I could write for 20 years and not come up with any of the good stuff that's in that episode. Like they were just incredibly well written and so funny and so tight.
One day you'll get there. But
and Thomas, what about you? What inspired you?
Well, I mean, I think this it's a total departure, as you know, in terms of like what you see with Silicon Valley. Richard, at least in terms of what I can play, is quite grounded and very much in the real world. But the stuff that inspired me, especially when I was younger, is like really crazy, absurd character stuff. Like the Monty Python movies really spoke to me. Spoke to my Anglophilic heritage and Kids in the Hall. I think anyone sort of growing up in Canada around my age in the 80s, 90s, Kids in the Hall were pretty important. It's one of the few entertainment pieces to come out of Canada that I can feel proud of. And those guys, they just had very absurd, weird sketches. Some of them were like, I don't even think supposed to be all that hilarious. Some of them were just supposed to be weird and styly and genre-y. And then later on, you know, like British Office and Extras and I must admit Seinfeld were all sort of like inspirational, but those seminal things were Kids in the Hall, Monty Python, like really wacky stuff.
Well, I want to thank all of you for talking with us. It's really been fun. Thanks for your series. I really enjoy it. And I wish you all well.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thomas Middleditch is the star of the HBO comedy series Silicon Valley. Mike Judge created the series. Alec Berg is the co-showrunner with Judge. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews a new album by soul singer William Bell, who co-wrote the song Born Under a Bad Sign. This is Fresh Air.